Okay, thank you, Matthew. And thank you all the organizers for bringing us together. It was stimulating, it's fun. What else can I say? Inspiring. Lots of navigation that I learned from all of you. Navigation in physical space, navigation in behavioral space, and all of us doing navigation in cognitive space too. So that's also exciting. So what I'm going to talk about is mostly about how insects fly and how they turn, and also trying to make some connection between the physical laws that's governing insect flight to the controls, which involving the second part, which is the neurons. So, of course, we have already mentioned this many times, that when you think about biological systems, everybody agrees that evolution plays an important role. And also everybody agrees that the physical laws also play an important role, physics, chemistry. And the challenge is, how do we start from physical laws actually to say something predictive or quantitative about behavior? And that's what we're facing. So I'm going to discuss these in the context of two organisms that we've been working on, dragonfly flight and flies. And so four-wing insects and two-wing insects. And I will mention some of the work that the questions we've been working on. So done with two students, James and Asan, and in the case of dragonfly, we also collaborate with Anthony, many of you know from Genevia. So I want to also have a theme of discussion. In this particular case, is reflexes. Okay. So and in particular, writing reflex. So what do I mean by that? So each of us have that and do that. In the case, me standing, and I am mechanically unstable because I'm an inverted pendulum. So center mass is above ground. So without any feedback control, in principle, I won't be able to give this talk. So you can think of the same thing with insects. That is, they are also intrinsically unstable if there's no neurofeedback circuitry. And they are also standing, and except that the medium they're standing is air. So they're standing in air. So immediately there's a question, how do they stand in air, or how do they fly in air? So one question is, obviously they flap their wings, so they generate enough aerodynamic forces to balance weight. But that itself is not enough, because it also has to sense its orientation fairly frequently, as we all see, in order to know where is its instantaneous orientation relative to gravity. And in response to that perturbation or deviation, it has to do something. And that something is what I call riding reflexes. So it's essentially studying about the equilibrium reflex of animals. So many of us, when we think about animal behavior, we do tracking, how, in other words, in kinematic space, how they move their wings and their body. And the other part I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talk about is, how do we analyze such behavior? And in that, we use dynamic models, flight simulation, in other words, like to simulate them with and without control. And then it gets us to think about, how would we control the fly so they can be stable, or they turn right, turn left, turn upside down, and all degrees of freedom. So insects, as you know, they navigate, the flying ones navigate in 3D spaces. So it's a lot of fun to think about rotation in 3D. And I don't have much time today to talk about optimizing flight. Once you know how to simulate them, you can ask the question, have insects optimize their flight through the course of evolution? Okay, and then there are many more things that I might touch on. So to start out with, let's look at this dragonfly and see if you see anything unusual about this. So first of all, it's a dragonfly that has four wings, and it initially, as you can see, the belly is up. So that means I was dropping this upside down, right? So just to see how it would respond to its funny orientation. So what you can see is, this is slowed down. So in about 100 or 200 seconds, it has no trouble to write itself. And in order to write itself, the body makes a rotation. So the body is this way, upside down, belly up. And so what it does is it managed to rotate itself, so it's dorsal up, right? So 180 degree turn in about a couple hundred milliseconds. And then if you look a little bit more closer, you say, the wings must be beating asymmetrically left and the right. And how are they beating asymmetrically so they can make this nice 180 degree turn? Okay, so that's the first part I'd like to discuss. So just to give you a quick answer, the reaction time is on the order of 50 to 100 milliseconds. And the recovery, this whole episode of 180 degree turn takes about 4 to 6 strokes. And then I'll get into the wings and the body. And then I'll say, what are the key asymmetries in the wing that leads to this stereotype turn? And the last thing I want to address is, how do they know they're upside down? So this, again, is a fairly generic picture that underlying a lot of us, a lot of what we do here. So here I happen to use visual stimulus, but you can't replace this by any external stimulus. If you think about the sequence of events, you start with some external stimuli and being perceived by the sensory system in the animal, and they send signals to the motor neurons. The motor neurons actuate muscles, and the muscles stiff. Change their tension and modulate the wing motion. And in our case, that wing motion interacts with air around them, leading to various maneuver, and which we will observe in their body motion. So lots of people in neuroscience here, and so lots of approach when we analyze this rather complex system. We have many ways to probe. So you can probe, just start from any level and see the architecture and their algorithms. And you can also start, for example, this is by far the best studied sensory vision. You start from playing different visual stimuli, so you see how they respond, and you also look at their behavior, the behavioral response. So the algorithm, one might tease out, could start from here and all the way going down to the body. And this is what we happen to be studying, which is that we started by analyzing the physics of flight, because that's where we actually can write down equations and solve them. And then little by little, we are moving up, because in order to understand, as I said before, the flight, not only we need to understand the physics of flight, but we also have to understand their control. And the control part is the synapse to the rest of the neuroscience. In other words, how are they being controlled? So in this, this is the way I'm going to tell you, mostly is the history of how we study dragonfly. Now, before I get to that, let me show you another example just to say that flying insects are unstable. So here's a simulation of a fly, so two-winged insect. And if you prescribe the wing motion, a family of periodic motion, and then you'll realize after you wait for 10, 20 wing beats, the body starts to drift and the body starts to tilt. And that coupling between the drift and the tilt eventually will make the bug tumble. So that's the instability I'm referring to. And this is called a pitch instability. There's another instability related to this. It's called a roll instability. You can do the same analysis. And if you allow the body to roll, it's also unstable. And that's very generic, yes.
Isn't that counteracted for by the halteres? And so shouldn't you also be modeling how those are moving?
The halteres function mostly as a sensor. Aerodynamically, is not large enough to counter that. So we also studied, so another example would be dragonflies, the front wing and the hind wing, and they do beat out of phase. And there, if you're not careful in placing the parameter, they often also, they also have an unstable regime. They have to be actually very careful separating them. So I will return to the stability and instability boundary a lot, actually. Any other questions?
Less severe than dragonflies?
So dragonflies, as I said, because of two sets of wings.
They can hover?
They can hover. That doesn't mean they don't use feedback. And so fruit fly can also hover. So that's what I'm going to talk about. So you have, it's possible to correct this and to make it hover. Yes.
So how does the half wind affect the stabilities of this?
How is
the half wind supposed now?
Head wing.
Yeah, suppose now the
Very good.
Flying in still air.
Make it slightly more stable. So it's called a forward flight.
I see.
Yes. So one can analyze all this. And ascending flight makes it less unstable. So they're actually, the stability indeed depends on these dynamic states. And I'll say how we quantify them.
Mm-hmm. Is there a stationary point in this process? Like if you wait for a long time, does it stay in some regime of drift?
So it's a limit cycle, but it's an unstable one.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions?
This is modeling or simulation?
Simulation.
This is basically you.
We compute them.
This is on the computer.
Yeah, correct. So that's the one thing I also want to say, that is, this is the reason you can do this is on computer, because you can disengage all the control feedback circuitries, and then you can bring them back on. So. The second piece, what I said, the second part of the work relating to the control of this, indeed it connects to Haltier. So in other words, as you saw, without any sensory feedback, it will fall. So what are the sensory feedback pathways that make a fly stable and it can hover? And so this leads us to think, study something which many of you study also, which are called Haltiers. And the Haltiers are these tiny little structures in the back. You can think of them as hind wings reduced to these tiny little vibrating organs. So they vibrate just like the way antiphase to the front wing. And the function of them becoming a sensor. And it's a very clever sensor. That is, it's vibrating, so it's like a pendulum. Now, the base of this vibration is on the body, and if the body is turning, this in principle will, relative to the body, experiences a Coriolis force. And that Coriolis force is proportional to the angular rotation rate of the body. And that's how the Foucault pendulum tells the Earth's rotating speed. So it sounds a little bit far-fetched initially. So as you can see, it took a long time before people actually work out bringing these this idea out. And many experiments later, for people start to have some confidence in the idea that this actually, the Coriolis detector actually gives you the sensory feedback. And then people were saying, what's then these signals? How is these sensor process? Kind of like actually Pavan was talking about, these mechanical sensors. And they can trace the nerves to various muscles. And there were few of them being recorded back then. And they said, okay, these receive inputs from Haltiers. Let's see how they fire. And they said, all these, at least those were, there were only four being recorded. There was something, there was this muscle, first vascular muscle, also being recorded, which has a little different property compared to other muscle firing pattern. And the unusual property, which is called a tonic firing, is that the fact it actually beats, it fires every wing beat. So unlike other muscles, only fires every so often when they want to turn. So I'll get into all of this later, but this is just to say, why are we paying special attention to this actually come from below? So what we did is to ask, using the computational model, to ask the parameter regime under which this flight can be controlled. That involves time scales and so on, which I'll explain. And that requires us to look for specific features in these neural recordings. Then we make a jump of conjecture to say that this particular muscle must be involved in regulating the pitch instability that we saw in the computational model. Okay, so I'll explain all this. Okay, now, so here's a little bit of preparation, just give you some sense of how we model our insect. And so it took quite a while for us to simulate this. And initially, we were interested in the fluid and the wing interaction. So that's a question of aerodynamics. In other words, in order to understand how they turn, how they generate forces, you have to solve the fluid equation coupled to the wing. And so that's governed by the Navier-Stokes equations. And so a lot of time was spent on developing methods, solving these problems. And so in some sense, that you can say is the simplest flyer you can think of. Okay. So that's a following paper. And then there are many organisms. Almost all, or at least the ones listed here, we all navigate in fluid environments. We also, people say, no, we don't, we walk, but we also push air. And in fact, the Reynolds number of each of us when we're walking is pretty high, 10 to the 5. Okay, so we don't take into account of that for most purpose. So the fact that there is always air and water in most living environment, which says fluids actually plays an important role in the physics part of this locomotion. And so for insects, the relevant Reynolds number is about a couple of thousand, which means inertia is important. So the reason I'm saying this is because if you study microorganisms, the Reynolds number is much smaller, so it's dominated by viscous force. And here is an interaction between the viscous and inertial forces. Okay, here's the equation we love, and that is the Navier-Stokes equation. And basically, is that says, well, the flow is governed by this equation, the velocity equation. And when you solve this, this says, well, the flow is governed by this. The complication is, apart from the equation itself, but the complication is usually when I look at the insect wing, the wing affects the flow. So there's an interaction between the two. But I won't dwell on this, except that we said we actually spent a lot of time trying to resolve these flow in the simple case of a single wing where you can actually solve accurately, and you have to worry about...
Sorry, this might be a little bit technical, but then... So the boundary condition you use,
yes,
is basically that the flow velocity is exactly the same as the wind velocity.
So that's called a no-slip boundary condition.
Is that true?
It's true to a very good accuracy. And in fact, you're talking about the atomistic level. People actually try to see when it slips. It's actually very surprisingly good. People think it might break down already on the order of, say, small scales, but they don't until maybe at the very few atoms.
Atomic scales, yeah. I see. Wow.
So this is, so for all purpose, it actually turns out to be a remarkably good boundary condition.
Exactly.
Yes, cool. Yes. Yeah, unless you study superficial fluid or something. Okay, so normal fluid. And then the question is, okay, now simulating one way, and lots of people studying fish, what about hydrodynamic interactions? And what if you have lots of waves? What if you have this and that, 2D versus 3D. So there are machineries, computational frameworks that one can build and to simulate all that. It is just very expensive. Okay, so in other words, their methods can be reasonably accurate. And in fact, one of the things we tried was trying to improve the accuracy and efficiency in these simulations. So if you say, I have 500 fishes, in principle, you can simulate them because the algorithm is available. But the question is a matter of time and effort and computing time. So this is just a bit of advertisement, actually. The model we are going to use is a much simpler version, which is because we want to evaluate many, many evaluations, and we want to do optimization and all this. And the model is extracted by looking at or studying the fall of a piece of paper in air or aluminum plates in water, right? Now, why is this picture beautiful? This tells me my audience.
Of course.
Why is this picture beautiful? Well, this is for later for coffee. But if you look at this, in fact, that's the simplest locomotion you can already construct. It's a flight. The reason it's a flight is, first of all, it travels from A to B. And two, it's flapping, like, so it's not gliding from A to B, which you can also do. But it's actually a signature of using periodic motion of this piece of a wing that generates a upward force, exactly balanced gravity. So what you can think of this is the inverse of that. The inverse is, if my wing is moving such a way, I should be able to generate such force, which actually balances the gravity. So it's a nice way of actually generating periodic motions that can fly. So that's why I think it's beautiful, and that's why we study it, and that's why I think this is a good way to study. Yes.
During this process,
yes,
it flips, right?
Correct.
Yeah. But our wing don't flip.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, just wait a second now.
Okay.
So this is, you simulate that. Okay, Turk says, let's simulate. See if the Navier-Stokes equation does give you this. Okay, it does that. And that was actually an easy regime to simulate. Okay, much harder is to simulate your kind of thing. Okay, but it requires a very simple tuning. All I need to do is to make the wing a little bit thinner. And basically, there's a dimensionless parameter, which is called moment of inertia, non-dimensional version. And you don't have to, it doesn't have to turn.
I see.
Right? So flapping can generate lift. Yes.
Is it rigid?
It's rigid for now. Yes. Yes. This is 2D simulation. We have 3D. You know, everybody loves 3D. But Boris, actually, I'll show you a 3D later. Okay.
Is it important?
Well, important and not important.
Right.
So this is very flexible. It's bending and a little bit, right? So it's bending. So what do they call this? Oh, there is actually something like that. That's more rigid, right? Yeah. So, of course, there are dimensionless parameters to characterize it. But the key here is just these very simple tuning can access different locomotion regime, if you like. And there's no neural feedback into it, soft physics. That's,
Jane, what happens if it's pulsatile flow rather
than... Pulsatile flow. Yeah, so you can study that too. So then there will be an interaction between the two. You can be in fact, Steve Chu just looked at some of this in a bug in a pulsatile flow, and they actually find that paper bug managed to hover. So that's also a very beautiful experiment.
But to be fair, this is there is a gradual descent, though. It's not a...
Absolutely right. Yeah. And there is a descent. In fact, that's also useful. It immediately tells you how much power being expended, mgh. And so it doesn't require that much to do that. Okay. So that's one part. So the aerodynamics. So that's just give you a flavor of the richness of the interaction between wing and the flow itself. And then the second part, which is also interesting, when you think about fixed wing, the wing is fixed, and there's a propeller at the back, and so the wing is just lifting the plane. But in this case, the wing does both. It has to flap and to generate weight, and everything, all the controllers and all that is in the wing. So the wing is multifunctional. But because it does all this, as you can see, I'm doing this, my body is already shaking. In other words, there is a coupling between the wing motion and the body motion. So this is the wings and a body coupling. And that can also be studied, and thanks to Newton and Euler. So that's what people in the literature usually call that multiple rigid body dynamics. And so for us, we have the body and two wings, and we can also model the wings by some parametrization that allows you to kind of play with any wing shape you like. It's actually can be done analytically. Okay, so that's our model for the physics part. And then we also have, because the Haltier can sense the state, it modulates the wing motion.
For this moment, the body is rigid, so there's no abdomen.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So there are other internal degrees of freedom. There are no legs, there are no antenna either. But for now, this is an abstract of the bug. Okay, so now the dynamics. So this is the body and the wing interaction, the body and the wing interaction, or the rotation of the body in space, is given by the Euler equation plus aerodynamic torques. And the reason I want to say this is when we interpret the rotation in space, it's actually often you find we don't have such a good intuition about it. And I think partly because we are 2D animals. And the other part is the rotation about different axes are all coupled, right? So pitch yaw row tend to be coupled unless the angular momentum initially is along those principal axes. So that's why it's fun to look at 3D rotation, because there's always a little bit of a surprise. And so now I do want to say that one thing that we gradually sort of move toward, as you can see, initially there's no body, now you add the body, so why bother, you can say. But it's very important because I think it is about understanding free flight, because often when you have to record, you have to tether them, and the wing does this, and the body respond. We don't exactly know what how the body responds. But this is a way for us to see the interaction between the two and know the body, because the body motion then also couple back to the wing and actually has interesting effects on the stability of flight. So if you ignore that, you might say the flight is stable or not stable, but once you couple that, actually gives you a little bit of a stability in the yaw direction. Okay. So let me see, which one is this? So this is to say, yes, those are the algorithm going into simulating this, and it's unstable. Now let's put some things to control this. Oh, maybe not, so I'll control this later. So, okay, so that's the model for little bug, and it's unstable. So this is a little bit of a digression. Because one of the topics I like to get across is to think about the stability of these organisms. So here's a maple seed. Again, we love. And so the maple seed, unlike the insect, even though the wing has a very similar shape, but it's very stable. Right? So you can convince yourself how stable it is when you drop from air. Now compared to a random piece of paper, how stable it is, by cutting away a little bit of the wing. So now I cut a little bit of the wing, and it still gyrates stably, right? It's very robust. And it was a surprise to us when we keep cutting, we cut almost all the wings. What? Yeah, right. So people were going to say, it's called a helicopter seed. Of course, because its wing looks like an insect wing, looks like a helicopter blade, must be important. Yes, it is very important. It slows it down. But this gyrating motion actually doesn't depend on the exact shape of the wing. Okay, so there's a mechanics going into this. But it turns out, of course, if you cut more and you say, oh, what if you drop this in vacuum? Well, that will not gyrate. They will just fall. So there is an interplay between a little bit of aerodynamic effect plus the geometry or the design of the seed such that it always gyrates. So now you can already think, oh, there's a morphological aspect to all this, right? So then you say, ah, there are a lot of seeds available to us, many, many species, and there are a lot of insects that we've seen. And if you just look at the wing shape, this could be a seed, this could be an insect wing. So there's actually common features between the two. And somehow, magically, nature likes those shapes when they interact in air. Except, when you drop them, they actually behave very differently. And these ones, if you drop them, they also tumble, they gyrate, they tend to be stable. But all of these, even though we haven't done the calculation, but there are some generic arguments going into it, they are fairly unstable. So the observation I like to make is when you are a plant or a seed, you don't have any neural feedback circuitry by design, and it's good to evolve to a shape that is stable. So why is that good? If it's stable, it means it floats in air for longer, it can be carried by wind and so on. It's good for dispersion. But if you are an insect, because of these wonderful neural feedback circuitry, they can handle a little bit of instability. Now, the even more interesting part is that instability, when we analyze them, is always marginally unstable. So the eigenvalue is actually very close to 1. So somehow these organisms have evolved, if you view them through the lens of stability, they evolved to this boundary of stability, which is just marginally unstable. And I think a human too, like people know that, yes.
What about birds? What about the wings of eagles?
Yeah. They're all unstable, I claim. And the planes are. And there's generic arguments going into it. So I'll, when I do the more quantitative study, I'll give you a little bit of a sense why it's generic. I mean, you can fine tune, you know, the plane has these the tails and so on. You make it more stable. But if you just have two wings, put along, distribute, next connect to the body, they tend to be unstable. Yes?
So just clarifying the question.
Yeah.
When you define stability,
yeah.
Instability,
yeah.
When you compare unstable and stable,
yeah.
Are you saying the wing of an insect is unstable, or are you saying
the body and the wing?
So yeah. If you just
when it flaps, so I will
take the wing off.
Yes.
Do the same kind of comparison as you did earlier for the seed, how would it behave?
So if you took the wing off, actually, so now this is an interesting. I drop wings too. The wings are so light, so it behaves a little differently. And if you look at these. In fact, one of the key features, yes, the wings are light, but there's a heavy nut. So if you attach a nut to these wings, they can't behave like that. There's nothing, I mean, physically you can find the parameters, they would behave like that. Yes?
So what is the behavioral benefit of like maintaining this point of
stability?
Is it adaptability, adaptation of the environment?
I think one way to think about that is less effort to turn. So maneuverability, that's the word being used. So how do we quantify stability, which I haven't said? So we now have a dynamical system, which is we can simulate these bugs, and you say, is this bug stable or not stable? How do I find out? One way is you say, I simulate for a long time and find out whether it's stable or not. Yes,
Mike? Is this true for fish and penguins and all that as well?
I like to make that general claim. I think all animals, except quadrupedal, they are enormous. I think not all animals are crabs, and they're stable, cockroaches, they're stable, landmark. But fish, certainly we saw it in Jimmy's talk and another David's talk, they're unstable. They're belly up when they're dead.
But wait, I mean, if I look at,
yeah.
I'm just trying to understand that. So if I look at the dog, for example.
Dog?
Is dog
stable? Quadrupedal.
Look at the dog, is asleep, it falls on the ground.
Oh yeah, that okay, right. So right. So if now there's a very interesting calculation which we physicists love because the potential energy is lower when they fall. Yeah, so it's even more stable. There's another even more stable system. stand up or this area, So right. So the explanation for that. So I'm just having a little bit of fun here. The explanation of that is the cost for falling is high because of impact and all that. Who knows? There's a height difference and all that. So all of this. So I'm saying there's something interesting about the evolution. We like evolution a lot. We think about it in morphological space, but here's another aspect we can think about, which is in dynamical space. Okay. So
I guess moving, I'm sorry for
okay.
Moving animals, that this argument about the maneuverability doesn't work. Because dogs and most of the predators.
Think about two-legged animals, bipedal.
But bipedal animals are not as maneuverable as
quadrupedal. You don't think so? They don't run as fast. Okay, so we can discuss that. So obviously, this is not a universal argument, but I'm just saying many animals we've looked at, insects, and it's surprisingly interesting that they evolved to that boundary of instability.
Okay. So then following the same kind of discussion, so what's the comparison here with the walking insects, which is, on one hand, you're claiming that there is an additional stability because of those multiple legs touching the
No, they'll be more stable.
It will be
But the large, because
there's six legs. Yeah.
Because each one, each time,
but the large proportion of the body is still flowing through fluid.
That's a small effect. Okay. This is a wing, flapping wing. So the air is important. When we walk, and even though I said I have generally a turbulent wing and so on, but it's a small effect, and nobody feels that wing, by the way. Okay. Yes. Yes, do you see what I mean? So the So in other words, you think about in your case the walking case. It's a tripod, so tripod is very stable.
Yes.
Yeah. So the reason bipedal is not stable is because our feet size is not big enough. Yeah.
So within this unstable regime, what's the distribution like? For like a vulture can just glide for a long time, and other birds have more maneuverability. Like a 747 is designed to be really stable, but fighter jets are super unstable because they want maneuverability, and you need that feedback system in a fighter jet, otherwise the thing will crash.
Correct.
And so I was just wondering if there's any correlation within these animals, if you can predict ones that are like prey, they want to be fast and maneuverable to get away from predators.
Yes. Short answer is yes. So in the real animal, it's a little hard to tease out because there's always a feedback control. So with these, you can calculate. So now I'm going to say how we calculate the stability.
But sorry to be insisting here. Yeah. You can shut me down.
No, this is great. That's why we're here.
If I understand what you're trying to convey here, the idea that there is this very beautiful instability point, and then the evolution in terms of the feedback that is required for the system to be operating in this unstable regime, but at the same time being able to control things.
Right? Yes.
If you're telling me that a tripod gating in a walking insect is super stable.
Oh, super stable. You mean...
I wanted to hear your sense in terms of the evolution of feedback control in a walking insect versus a flying insect.
The feedback control. Oh yeah. So how would you? In other words, it will require a little longer conversation. In other words, what I'm saying is, so far what I said is standing have more stability. In other words, basically you're counting the area of support, right? So it's more stable. In other words, if I'm standing, I can lean forward a little bit, lean back a little bit. Doesn't matter. But in the locomoting space, when they are walking, we have to think about.
I have to remind you that they walk on the ceilings and the walls quite a lot. So
Actually, there's actually a film at the end. In fact, a lot of flies, in fact, in the tubes, they always walk on the side. So that's actually related to this. Okay. So are you interested in this diagram with me? Meaning that, in fact, you can actually calculate the stability. So the stability is that, let's use that fly as an example. You simulate the fly wing beat. You, in principle, it's a periodic orbit, and then the body have to return to its own state. And if you perturb it a little bit, it will return to a slightly different state. and you can calculate the derivative of that. So one dimension, everybody knows that's derivative. In higher dimension, it just becomes a Jacobian matrix. All the, people use various names for this. So you do that, and then you calculate the eigenvalues of that, and you find if there's an eigenvalue greater than 1, then it's unstable. So in principle, we can quantify. So to get back to your earlier question, is you can actually see how the stability depend on the speed, right? So it becomes more unstable here, and the only regime you find them stable is actually falling, descending. So in most animal, in most fly states, they are unstable. In fact, the early experiments, so one of the first experiments, when you cut halteres, they tumble and fall. Right? So in the falling state, you might see some strange stability. So the generic argument goes something like this. So it's really a balance, kind of a perturbation about this unstable state. So initially, I have a force, aerodynamic force, balancing the weight. And if there's a little bit of deviation, and in order to keep a balance this, what I need to do is kind of move forward to balance it, catch it, right? But in the insect case, is it moves forward, and there are two effects happening. If the wing are doing exactly the same thing, that upward force is no longer upward anyway, and that upward force will have a force direction component opposing to that tilt, okay, opposing to that forward motion. And if you have a horizontal component of the force, and it's away from the center of mass, which means it's going to generate a torque. And that torque, all of a sudden, is going to pitch the body. So now you can imagine there's interaction between these 2 degrees of freedom. Eventually, that oscillation can grow. So depending on the parameters, but that's why it's very generic. Yes?
Would you say that matching the center of lift and the center of mass is in general very hard?
So they don't. So that's why it's generic.
But there's also a morphological constraint, because it's very hard to match these two to be along the same line.
If we go bilateral symmetric ones, they should be on the same line.
At the same point as well?
No, it's not the same point. But it's on this longitudinal plane.
Right.
Yeah. So you're saying it could also yaw and so on. In other words, if it's off, it could. But let's say it's a bilateral symmetric object.
I see. It's pretty cool. Yeah. So for
insect, the arguments for row and the yaw also. So yaw is stable.
So insect with just a pair of wings. So if we really just collect the statistical data of them, is there a specific ratio of the moment of inertia and where the wings spread out? Is there a specific ratio, like universal number of that?
So I'm not going to talk about that particular result, but we did a study the effect of that position, the hinge, so we have a prediction. So you're so interesting, Stabler, so let me tell you this. So then people say, so center mass, right? So you can say, I can change the hinge position along the body. Mm-hmm. And or to the stability, and it can make it stable. Maybe it's above, make it more above very slow. So we can actually apply such analysis to do that. It turns out, it's very interesting, as long as it's within the body length, it's always unstable. Good. We have to be really, really high in order to be stable. So now what's the significance of moving this thing along? It turns out it affects the ascending speed for the same stroke. So it does have an significance, even though it's a minute adjustment. But there's a special sweet spot for it.
I'm sorry, I just remember some effect that I learned a long time ago about stability of the star. You actually can stabilize the inverted pendulum by vibration in the different frequency.
Yes.
And without any feedback.
Yes.
Basically.
N of them. Huh? In fact, the generalized result is you can stabilize N pendulum, not just 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, right.
Yes. It's a nice dynamical
system.
But that
depends on the frequency of oscillation.
Correct. Yes.
If that is playing a role here, basically, because you have a mass of the body, the stability comes from pure kind of...
So the simulation is taking into account this vibration. So it is a coupled oscillator. The wings are oscillating, right? So the wing is oscillating and the body is oscillating. But just that pure coupling always gives you instability. So you do have to modulate the wing motion.
Okay.
Okay. So now, how do we stabilize this? And so we stabilize this. So we have lots of questions. In particular, I want to address two questions, which both involve time scales. One is, how often do I have to sense the body state in order to stabilize this bug? And two is, how soon I have to react? So that involves time delay. So these are the theoretical questions we can try to address. And the way you stabilize this is a very small adjustment in the wing. So the wing normally flaps forward and back. This is a top view. Symmetrically, let's say symmetrically forward and back. It doesn't have to be. So there's some mean position of this, your arc. And all you need to do is shift this mean stroke forward and back ever so slightly in response to the body rotation, and that's sufficient to stabilize. Okay. So to implement this algorithm, so the intuition is, it's kind of like my intuition. If I want to balance this, I kind of follow this. Okay. So now the way we implement this is, we have that mean stroke angle, that little shift we talked about. And it's proportional to what the deviation is. The body is deviating. And a little bit of the angular rotational rate. That usually stabilizes things a little bit. But the majority comes from this proportional control. So like most of the proportional control, you have a gain factor. You also, in this case, we also take into account time delay, because that is real. And then here's the algorithm you can follow. So now once you have this, then you have my tau is a parameter we can study. And the other thing we can introduce is how often we sense. And this discrete sensing state, I also think, is fairly generic. Right, so they don't sense necessarily have to be continuous. They sense every once in a while. So now the parameter study based on these two time scale is gives you the following. First of all, you can find the combination of those that stabilize the bug, right? So this is stable, at least on computer, so that's a hovering fly on the computer. And then you realize, actually, the control effort is very small. So these adjustments that we need is on the order of degree or fraction of degree. And so if you actually measure this experimentally, it's very hard to tease out, first of all, because there's no ideal states. But nevertheless, this also tells you don't require very much to remain stable. That kind of makes sense. And then we have to look through this phase diagram in terms of those two parameters. So the blue correspond to the parameters that such an algorithm can control this computer bug. Well, that's very interesting. You say, okay, well, it kind of makes sense. You can't tolerate too much of a delay. Small delay is good. And you shouldn't wait too long to sample, so that's all good. Okay, so at first, you know, when, yes?
So if one was to not stabilize every wing beat, but let's say every other wing beat, so if you increase tau, then the amplitude would...
So it goes like this. So you sample every two wing beats, and you have to act a little bit sooner. So there's a trade-off between the sampling rate and the delay. So this gives you this nice linearity, actually, strangely so.
But how does it know the up direction?
Yeah, so how does it know it's the up direction? So this I will get to you in the dragonfly talk. Gravity sensor, if I have time to get to. Actually, so should I just talk very fast? Okay. So I can speed up. So which is to say, you kind of look at this diagram for a little while and da-da-da-da-da. And then you say, okay, there's some other arguments we can make. And you can draw this binding bonding box. You say, according to the simulation, and this part would kind of indicate this is where the actual fly might operate. These are the parameter regime. And then you say, oh, great. What is in this? You say, look at the sampling rate. The sampling rate is either one every wing beat or every two wing beats. Oh, that's also good. which means integer wave beats, or you have some robustness. This, anyway, to make the very long story short, then we said, oh, actually, the best, of course, to sample every wave beat, and that would lead to a delay about a little less than three wave beats, and that's somewhat consistent. And then I'm going to say a few more things. Yes.
So there's a linear relationship between the parameters?
Yeah.
And is this also a theoretical result of the control of
No, this is a computer result.
Yeah.
And I don't have an explanation for that yet. I have other things about control of, but not this. So so flight says every way beat to stabilize flight, And then this leads us to look inside. What's going on in the muscles and the neurofeedback circuitry. And this is what I started out saying. There's a long literature on Halteres, and I'm going to skip all the physics or the mathematics of it, but to say that there is a pair of Halteres which can give you a rotational rate. They act like a gyroscopic sensor. And then you see the muscle picture we already saw here, that the flies are actually actuated by these indirect, powerful muscles. But the muscles were interesting are the ones next to the wing beats, the wing base. They're called steering muscles. And lots of works on these bigger flies, and so they can look under microscope. And that was actually a preoccupation, probably the beginning of the 20th century, in trying to tease out what the muscles are and pulling the wing and see what they possibly can actuate, and so on and so forth. And there are much more recent works, as Sanjay can tell you more about. So the B muscle is somewhere here, and it doesn't matter. It's one of the waist muscles at the base. And the reason that clued us into this particular muscle, possibly among other muscles, is these two pieces of work. So Hyde, as I mentioned before, when he was recording these various muscles, he noticed that B1 is firing every wind beat. So when we say, oh, that's very good, we need something to stable sense this fly to sense every state. So if this muscle is firing every wind beat, that's a natural candidate for fly stability. And there's another piece of evidence coming from Dickinson's lab, actually a while back, where they also repeat some of these experiments, but adding to that is a simultaneous measurement of the wing motion. So they can try to correlate a little bit of the wing motion. Now the wing motion they analyze is in the amplitude direction, so that's one direction, but there's already something interesting. That is, there is a what they call rostral shift. So there's a correlation of this forward and hind back shift seems to correlate this. And when I looked at this, I said, oh, perfect, because that is the kind of a control we need for pitch instability. So now I'm putting these two statements together. And so there's a new work coming out, which now can measure recording at a slower time scale, many more muscles. But I won't get into it until unless you have questions. But here's a conjecture that we made before seeing all these results, new results, is that this muscle is critical for regulating, in particular, pitch stability. Right? So that's a reasonable test. So then I was in Genelia doing dragonfly experiments, which I have not started talking about. And so I was having lunch with people and asking, oh, do you know anything about B1 fly? Can you do something, knock out the neurons? And of course, in Genelia, they say, yeah, sure, until we talk to them. So they point me to this nice fellow, Choi Sharanji. And Choi Sharanji, I've been studying B1 flies. Yeah, yeah, what do you want? Oh, what are they? Okay, so he said, oh, yeah, these are just big muscles. And it has something to do with something rather. And I said, do you know how they fly? He said, oh, I have no idea. So apparently, people don't really look at their fly behavior yet, at least when I was talking to Troy. But he was very nice. He said, I said, well, I can give you some. So great. So he gave you some. He made some, actually, specifically made some for me. And he handed back to me these two tubes, right? So one is control fly, the other is B1 fly. Well, here's your flies. And I look at this, so here goes my theory, of course. They look identical, I can tell them apart at all. And what they do is they just walk upon, along the tubes, as you see mostly in the lab, and that's why people don't really look at how they fly, because they are lazy people, and they're lazy flies, and they walk along the tube. I said, okay, there goes. But Anthony's lab has the high-speed video camera, so I can put easily in front of a high-speed camera. So these are the first batch that Troy gave to me. So these are the B1 flies. But they don't seem to fly so well, actually. Yeah, they don't seem to fly so well, right? So you can say, okay, there's lots of subtle questions. But then actually, once you can see, they already don't fly so well.
Where did you do
B1
in this case?
B1?
Where did you do the B1 mostly?
I didn't do to B1. He knocked out the neuron, B1 neuron, exactly. He used big words, and toxin, this, and toxin, that. I'm immersed in all these neuroscience talks, but I have not absorbed all the alphabets.
But some toxins. Selective knockout, I think.
How selective it is, right. So that's a question Troy can answer. But I can tell you it's not 100% select. It probably targets some other neurons in the mushroom body, which is something that people were very excited about there, okay? You know, it was great to be there listening to all these talks. Now I actually can at least say, oh, mushroom body, central complex, and all that, even though I have not seen them, except in videos. Okay, so then you compare with the other group, which is a control fly. They also do this thing, and they also fall because they get very crowded up there, and they take off. And they do fall, but they fall in a much more pitch-controlled way. So these are the two contrasts you can make between the two. So these fall, and they lost the pitch, and they kind of trying to recover maybe, and they lost again. So this kind of loss of a pitch never happens in controlled, in the intact fly. All right, so this is at least consistent with what we're saying. And then you say, oh, let's do statistics, let's do da-da-da. This is a nice way to visualize this because it makes me think about the spin and the right?
Yes.
Right. So it's a very nice visual way to look at the coherent state. And so now you can immediately see how they tumble. These the genetically modified one tumble, and the other ones stay more coherent relative to gravity. So anyway, so that's as far as I've got. And people now trying to, you can knock out specific muscles and observe their flight and so on. But for me, it was exciting because it did start with theory in this case, which is rare, right?
So if you cut the halteres of the flight, do you get the same?
They tumble. So that was the 1700s, so the earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they just tumble. They don't fly at all.
I don't fly, right?
Yeah, they don't fly at all. So that's how they discovered as a sensory organism of balance. So there was this long discussion why eventually leading to Pringle to say that's a gyroscopic sensor. Okay, so very, very quickly, I spent a lot of time here, and I want to tell you, go back to the early movie on dragonfly. So you can say how, so the dragonfly is a little bigger, a little older, and the direct muscles, four wings, and so this is a beautiful picture from Anthony's lab where you go to the genelia pound and you see they're laying eggs so they can hover. There's an interesting, rich behavior. That's his beautiful arena still there, I think. So we track a lot of the free flying, so trying to understand their behavior. But my point is it's complex and rich, and we can say something. So now I was there, as I said, on sabbatical. So I said, it'd be nice to do something that can elicit repeatable behavior so we can analyze them. That hence the drop of the belly up, the upside down orientation. So you can record them, you can da-da-da-da-da-da. So, so now here's data. These are the quick things you can measure in terms of reaction. You say, what is the body doing? The body is turning 180 degrees, and there's a little bit of yaw, a little bit of a pitch, because as I said, they're always coupled, but to the generic, it is a stereotyped reflex, that it always row when you drop at a starting with the same orientation. If you start from a different orientation, it will elicit a slightly different behavior. And this amount of rotation comes from the wing pitch asymmetry. So these are what the wing's doing. And the wing pitch asymmetry, when you see that, what you often see is the left and the right is having this asymmetry as you need. But when you analyze the asymmetry of these degrees of freedom, everything got mixed it together. You say, here's the asymmetry, it must be important. Here's the asymmetry, that must be important. So this is actually a kind of question maybe the people can tease out with automated algorithm. But what we did is instead some of these things I will say. So I won't bore you with all these possible asymmetries you can use to Turing in principle, but to say that we can study statistically how the rotation is correlated with these various wave pitch asymmetry, and then you can narrow down to a few parameters. But also there's a nice binary test you can do, that is, the body sometimes rotate to the right, sometimes rotate to the left. So it's a binary test. So if the asymmetry flips the sign in the wing, flips the sign, that will correlate the flip in the of the sign in the body rotation. Do people still follow me at this point?
One question I have. Yeah. So you're really comparing left and right, and you're not comparing front and back.
We do all four, actually.
Ah.
Yeah. So all four waves are tracked. And in fact,
the symmetries are really mapped into the left, right, and not so much.
So as you can see, all fours are tracked. So these are the four ways. Solid is four, and this is that. Okay. Yeah. So now you can see that.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's okay. I mean, it's a lot to see in this. Okay. So then you say, so when I flip, so if you compare this, for example, it flip. For now, all you can see is left, you know, blue is below, blue is the top, and so there's something that's flipped when we actually look at the wing pitch asymmetry. So that was a clue to the wing pitch asymmetry. So wing pitch asymmetry could lead to this term. And then James spent a lot of time simulating this. Is this true? So you can implement both the wing stroke asymmetry, which a lot of people advocate, because that's easy to measure, by the way. And wing pitch asymmetry is very hard to measure, and it's now, but it can be measured. So we can tease out the difference between those two. And turns out, for the dragonfly, it is the wing pitch asymmetry is enough to rotate. So in order to appreciate this, kind of have to know whether, you know, the stroke plane is relative to the body, which is not orthogonal, it's different from the flight. But nevertheless, at least I hope the simulation itself says that if you just implement wing pitch asymmetry without stroke asymmetry, it's sufficient to turn just like what you observe. But vice versa is not true. Okay. So a last question, gravity sensor. And he asked the question, but he left. So. Oh, you are. Oh, sorry. So I don't have such a good. Obviously, I wasn't tracking you. Okay. So gravity sensor. So now the obvious question is, you know, how do they know they're upside down? Like, when they fall, when do they react? So I asked the people again. So do you know the gravity sensor? They said, probably in the antenna, probably in the legs, right? People talked about those in the legs, like plants. They have these possible ways to detect the gravity. And I thought, okay, where could it be? It turns out it's in the vision, I think. So what do I mean by vision? So in other words, if you actually drop this in dark, they don't have a response. So they don't have inertial, unlike us, we do have inertial sensor.
They're still flapping their wings.
They don't.
Okay. So they just shut down the system.
Oh, you think so? Okay, we can know. No. So the eyes are blocked, completely blocked, and they're not doing anything, and they don't drag. So we can, I love to hear more of your thoughts on this. But at least when the eyes are completely blocked, they're kind of, I'm sorry to report, they don't respond. Yes.
What? If you drop the fly in the featureless environment,
yeah.
The fly, but there's no features.
So in this, no, no, no.
They don't glide at all. No, but they don't know what
no, no, no. So
no, not in the dark, in the white.
But that remember, Anthony's.
So I already have another response. So if you drop them normal side, they do flap. So there is.
Okay.
That will be a control. That will be a control. That will be a control to do.
But Michael Reiser, walked on the ground, it says on fire. They actually, why they climb up?
I know. So I read in the literature, I talked to Michael Reiser, said, oh, we looked at this in fly because that's called a gravity, sensor. And he said, we didn't find anything. That was, he says, people said that there's this antenna, there's this in the leg, and I looked at some of their reviews. But my point is, the experiments we saw, once there's no light, they don't respond. So we can try to put those things together later.
I actually had a question before you transition to this, and I think it's pertinent for this part.
Okay.
So were you able to track the head on those rolling?
Yeah. So I get to the head too.
Okay.
I get to the head too. So now head comes in. The head has lens, carries the lens. So what we think is actually, so this is also a physiology, people you should know this. They have compound eyes, they have three ocelli. Three is marvelous because it gives you a plane. And the ocelli are what's called a simple eyes. They are low resolution detectors, and they are sensitive to, say, 370, sort of blue ultraviolet. So this is what you see with the ocelli eye. This is what you see with a normal compound eye. So the key thing is that they differentiate light in the dark. So what they're good for, it can be, has been proposed that it's good for detecting horizon. Okay, so actually these are things that have been said in the past. Oh, it could be a way to detect horizon, therefore it's an equilibrium, and so on and so forth. So now this gets connected to the head motion. And then I was looking at some of the literature, and the one picture that stood out for me was this picture. That was Ben Mittelstaedt. And in his picture, he had this drawing, which says, well, he's playing with the light, left and the right, and to see how the head respond to the light orientation. Does that make sense? So you shine the light from top or you shine the light from the side, see if the head respond to the light, right? Because they would track the horizon, which is the light and the dark boundary. And what interests me was the fact he also happened to draw this very schematic wing orientation. And it is a pitch that he drew. And I don't know why, it's a tether device. And he managed to think that the wing is pitched differently. So now I'm trying to put them again together. So it looks like it's the ocelli and a compound eye that detects the horizon, gives it the sense of up and down. And that regulates both how the head rolls and how the body rolls. Exactly where the head leads to the body, or simultaneously, there are different descending neurons to both the head and the body. That's your job, right? Neuroscience. Okay. So I would love to actually. Yeah.
You can tell me.
Yes.
That we know in the fly there is a halter sending information going to interneurons that goes back to the ocelli.
Okay. Okay.
So
great. Right.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Thank you. So one more line. Okay. So anyway, based on these experiments, we can say this is happening because the reaction time, we can also give a time scale on it. And because the simulation, we can also say what that time scale is. So within that recovery, 200 milliseconds, about half, okay? So I would love to hear the thoughts from the neuroscience who actually look at these things. But let me just to summarize, which is, here we looked at two reflex systems, and the fly and the dragonfly, and in both cases we were looking at their response initially at the behavioral state or the dynamics of the body and so on, but as a way from that we gradually connected to the neural sensory feedback and both in the fly case and the dragonfly case. Last slide. to explain why what I mean by Newton's law to neurons, and I hope that's self-evident. Right? Gravity is important, and the gravity shapes the evolution of organism. Okay, so that's all I want to say.
Question about the feedback in the spinal, but I missed it. So you identified that so one particular muscle so feedback pathway. Is it one of many, or it is sufficient to stabilize roll, yaw, towel tumbling?
Okay, good question. I got it.
All the possible instability.
Okay, so Boris is asking, is that feedback in the fly case is the only one you need to stabilize everything? And the short answer is no. That stabilizes the pitch, but you need another set to stabilize roll minimally. So you do actually. So now.
Yeah. So is there some way of figuring out how many there should be? Three oil angles, so there
should be
pathways.
Yeah,
Or should there be more?
So there should be two, at least two. So minimally two. Pitch is unstable, roll is unstable, yaw is stable, relatively stable. You don't get the heading right, but the motion is there. Okay, so at least theoretically we need two. And so now this actually is very good, because I said that there is this new set of experiments that I haven't discussed. Where would that be? I think it's this, right? So this is the new work where you actually know more, a little bit more about these muscles. So I said there are 17 muscles, but these are 12 muscles being recorded in fly. They are a little bit low resolution, but nevertheless, they can tell you whether they're tonic firing versus these phasic firing. So I was looking through this, and then they said, okay, there's actually a couple more. So I said, B1 is, and now they know B3 is. And they also have this. So, but they also group together. So if I just interpret this again, I would say B1, B3 are responsible for pitch instability. And these, Sandra taught me how to say this, right? 3-1-3 blah, and is possibly responsible to roll. And then you can see, it is probably related to the amplitude shift between left and right. And those are the two, at least minimally, you need two groups. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you see these movies of hovering wasps, that the body rolls but the head stays perfectly stable, I was wondering, could the feedback explain that, or do you need a feed forward as well, like a motor command to turn the roll?
Yeah, they have different algorithm, right? In other words, so as I think we saw in human too, you gaze, this experiment, this and with our head. So they're far more complicated reference going on, reference copy generated to fix your gaze versus you co-move with the model. So I'm sure that's something else. That's also going on in
So in terms of the flight control, what is the advantages and the disadvantages for having four wings compared with having two wings?
Right, so that's a very good question. And so let me bring you up that slide. I did have a comparison between the two. Oh no, it's not this one. Okay. So, so they're actually, as I said, dragonfly, they are more ancient. And they flap a little slower, 30 to 40 hertz. So, in fact, they are controlled directly by direct muscles. So each wing base are controlled by maybe 6 or 7 muscles, right? Small number of muscles, but they are directly controlled. So you might say, now this gives individual controllability of each. So you have four things to control. That gives you a lot of maneuverability. Yeah, that's one solution. And the other solution is the fly, where the left and the right wing, the muscles already have a division of labor. The power muscle only drives them up and down. And then these smaller muscles regulate these fine changes in the wing motion. So when you say which one is good, which one is not good, I think both are a good solution for their design, but it's hard to compare to say, I don't use this. The reason you have to go to indirect muscle is because at these small ones, in order to float in air, you have to be so fast, so direct muscle wouldn't be able to do that. So they have to evolve muscles. So there are lots of things have to be evolved simultaneously, right?
But in the numerical simulation, it would be really interesting to just get the ratio. Is that you just in the numerator you see the output power,
and what?
The output power, how the insect flies, that would translate into energy.
Yes.
And then also the input power. I mean, then one can compare which mode. Both modes are stabilized. You beautifully demonstrated, but then one can then see which one is a more efficient engine. Yeah.
So in fact, actually, they're very similar. So in terms of, if you think about muscle-specific power, you know how much muscle power per weight they supported. And that's another, I think, a fairly universal feature. It's fairly similar.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Well, they're made from similar units, motor units. So it's a scale up in one. But these are the questions I'm actually currently thinking about, how to scale things up, for example.
Yes.
Maybe we should screw you up.